And joining me this afternoon in the KRVS studios is Charles Richard. He is a professor here at UL Lafayette and director for the Center for the Moving Image Arts Program. It is a new program that has attracted a lot of attention on campus. A lot of kids are fascinated by the program. And so you deal with a really wide range of interests among kids. And that's why it's called the Moving Image Arts Program,
right,
rather than film studies or cinematography. So it really covers everybody's interests.
That's correct.
Yeah. You also were honored this past spring. You were named one of the university's distinguished professors. That's an honor that's given to a couple professors every year. And for your work getting this center started and all of your work with the students, you were honored this year. So congratulations.
Thank you very much. It was very, very humbling to receive that.
It was. And it was very interesting to be there as you received it in absentia.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was a lovely moment. It was very, very nice.
I find that my wife gives better speeches than I do, so I think from now on I'm going to send her in my place.
Abigail did a great job, so that was a very, very nice touch to your year. You have been, throughout this year, working on a new film called In the Mind of the Maker, which we'll be talking about today. It's a documentary. It is a nuanced, layered documentary that has to do with a boat builder from Louisiana, but also some really high-tech aspects of the university research community here at UL Lafayette that we'll talk about. So let's start off talking just a bit about your background as a filmmaker and give people a sense of the range of films that you have made, primarily documentaries.
That's correct.
Tell us about some of the films you've worked on.
I think it's this year that it marks 20 years that I first started out in filmmaking. I started out really as an intern while I was in graduate school and worked my way up to the rank of an associate producer on a film called American Utopia. And that one was through LPB. It was broadcast nationally on PBS in 1994, 95. And so from there, I just kind of went on, mostly working with great producers at LPB. And I'm very happy to say that the kind of collaboration that we did allowed us to reach audiences far beyond Louisiana's borders. And so I've been very, very fortunate to work with some great talent at LPB. And most of the work that I've done has always centered on Louisiana culture, Louisiana history, different aspects of our way of life here. And the reason for that is that I feel most comfortable sticking close to home. I think there's a great responsibility that you have when you are a documentary filmmaker. You are obligated to tell the truth. And that's not always as easy as one might think. It means that you have to know the truth inside and out. And as we know from reality TV shows and places, other kinds of media that have been coming to Louisiana lately, they don't often get it right. And so I wanted to make sure that I stick with the subject matter that I know that I stand a reasonable chance of getting it right.
Yeah, I think at any party or reception or gathering you go to, some one of those series is going to pop up and people are going to talk about just how they didn't get it right.
That's it's inevitable. And so.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's not just as easy. Documentary filmmaking is not as easy as pointing your camera and just filming whatever comes. There is an artistry to it. It's obviously not fiction, but you are framing a story.
Absolutely.
So tell us about how you approach that aspect of storytelling, because documentarians are all different. How do you approach a story?
I think that you're right. All documentarians are different. And documentary actually is a lot more personal, I think, than maybe people realize at first glance. You can take a room full of documentary filmmakers, present them with the same piece of nonfiction material, and they're going to interpret the meaning of that story in lots of different ways, and they're going to filter it through their own lens. And that's what I meant earlier when I said that telling the truth is not just such an easy and obvious thing in this medium. So for me, I look at the stories that I think are compelling to me personally, first and foremost. I don't want to work on something that I'm going to be bored by because I know that my audience will be too. And I also look for stories that I think speak to larger truths through smaller stories. One of my partners on this film and in many other films has been Connie Castile, another great documentary filmmaker who shares my same love of telling large truths, I hope, through small stories.
Choosing a little slice of our culture like ironing or horse culture or plate lunches, and suddenly you're right, it does start telling more about us as a culture, gives a bigger picture than just that little subject matter.
That's right.
So this film is ostensibly on the ground level about a boat builder and the traditions of boat building in Louisiana. How were you attracted to this particular story and this particular man?
I think it was about 10 years ago, before I came to work in academia. I was working as a full-time independent producer and writer, and I was asked to write a story about Louisiana's native boat building traditions, and the article was to be published in Coastal Living magazine. At the last minute, it was sent over to their sister publication, Southern Living. But it gave me the occasion to learn about native boat building traditions, and there were very, very few of the old-time masters still around. There were a number of apprentices who were crowding around these guys and trying to learn as much as they could while they still could. And I think the thing that caught my attention the most, aside from just the sheer beauty and richness of their designs, was the way that they built these boats. The old-time masters didn't use any kind of blueprints or plans or any kind of recorded measurements even. And this was very mysterious to me. You know, speaking for myself, I struggle with the idea of building a bookshelf without, you know, a blueprint. So when you look at some of these beautiful designs, such as in our film, we're focusing on the Creole rowing skiff, which is a very, very elegant craft that's found nowhere else in the world but in the swamps of South Louisiana. You look at this and you ask yourself, how is it possible that somebody could create something so perfectly proportioned and also perfectly functional without a plan, without a drawing or something like
or
that?
Or going to boat building school or taking an engineering class, that it just came out of the culture, things that they had watched and imaginings.
Yes. And what was striking to me in talking to some of the journeyman boat builders at the it's called the Center for Traditional Louisiana Boat Building. It's now located in Lockport, and at that time it was at Nichols University. The teacher that I was talking with in particular was a younger man who was learning from some of the old-timers, and he says, you know, when this knowledge is lost, it's gone for good because these designs aren't recorded, and the process is essentially a mental process for building these boats. And if you don't communicate that mental process from generation to generation, it's lost. So there was a real urgency at one time for preserving these things. So this stuck in my mind for a lot of years, and especially the part of how visualization could lead to such incredible works of material culture. And then a few years ago, Dr. Ray Brasseur in the anthropology department here approached me and said, you know, somebody really needs to do a documentary about Louisiana's native boat building traditions because these are boats that are found nowhere else in the world and they're disappearing and the knowledge of them is, and somebody needs to capture this on film. And what Dr. Brasseur, Ray, was most interested in especially was in capturing the designs of these boats by using new three-dimensional imaging technologies. And the reason for this, I immediately knew where he was going with this. That's essentially our modern answer to what the old-time boat builders were doing between their ears. Mm-hmm. They were creating complex 3D visualizations of the craft that they wanted to create. And at one time, this was a pretty common ability among these kinds of craftsmen. But today, it's relatively rare and almost lost. And instead, we rely on places like the Light Center to do those kinds of complex 3D visualizations.
Right, and that's a place that you're quite familiar with because your offices were there at one point for the Cinematic Arts Workshop.
I have a research fellowship also with the Light Center. There's a really wonderful interdisciplinary group that utilizes the technologies at the Light Center, and most of them are really, really smart scientists, so I feel a little out of place among them. I'm one of the only humanists over there. But
well, and through your filmmaking, you are actually bringing those two worlds together, and we're going to talk a little more about the Light Center and how you're weaving that into this story. Right. As you mentioned, Dr. Ray Brasseur, he is somewhat of an expert on these boats. I think he is the expert. And as with many other things, Ray has just been quietly amassing this wonderful knowledge about so many aspects of our culture for so long. You have also an interest in the water and fishing. So that's very visceral to you, the practical side of being able to use a boat in the water. So you have this desire. You have this urgency. You've got some experts, professors here at UL Lafayette, and your skills. And how did you find Mr. Cuvillier, the boat builder? Is he somebody that you had known before or?
No, I was introduced to him by our two lead subject matter experts, and really they're sort of our on-camera guides to the story, and that is Ray Brasseur and also Jim Delahousie, who is an amazing, amazing repository of Louisiana folklore and history. Jim is single-handedly responsible for the Library of Congress's collection in the Folklife Division on the Atchafalaya Basin. Without his work, there would be no collection of materials at the Library of Congress on the Atchafalaya Basin in the Folklife Division. So Jim had been associated with the Cuvillier family, gosh, since he left graduate school. I would say that was probably the early 1970s. And Jim has a great story. He left graduate school with, ABD as a biologist, and decided that he wanted to take up the life of a trotline fisherman living in the basin. And he will tell you himself that he was failing pretty miserably at this. He wasn't catching enough fish to really keep body and soul together. So the Cuvilliers were one of the families that took him under their wing, taught him the craft of living in the basin, survival. He got it right at the last breath of life in the basin, because after the mid-1970s, the Army Corps of Engineers had basically evacuated all of the folks who lived in the Atchafalaya Basin. And so he was learning from some of the last true settlers in the basin.
And he knew of the Cuvilliers and knew that this boat-building skill resided in their family.
Yes.
Had he ever seen one of these particular skiffs, the Creole skiffs that you were talking about? And how did you decide that this was the boat that you wanted to document Mr. Cuvillier making?
The answer to your first question is that, yes, actually Jim is partly responsible for the persistence of this craft. He was able to secure a modest grant from the state back in the days when the state still gave money to support the arts and humanities, et cetera. He was able to secure some funding that was designed to help the transmission of folk knowledge from one generation to the next. And so this grant purchased the lumber necessary for Mr. Cuvillier, who's 85 years old now, to teach his sons the craft of boat building. And Jim had also been there to observe the variety of different kinds of boats that they built. The one that we selected, the Creole rowing skiff, we chose because it is increasingly rare. The story, as I understand it, is that none of them had been built really since the 1950s, and they were really in danger of being lost altogether. They're a rowboat, and so once motorized engines came along, they became really obsolete. You could still find bateaus and other kinds of traditional Louisiana boats because you could put a motor on them. This one, nobody was building anymore. And then in about 1984, when New Orleans hosted the World's Fair, the theme that year was about rivers and waterways and so forth. And Dr. Ray Brasseur was instrumental in persuading one of the last boat building masters, Raymond Setatal, to construct one of these old-fashioned crafts and demonstrate it as part of the World's Fair. And to the best of my knowledge, that's the first time that one had been built in decades.
So he constructed this Creole skiff for the World's Fair.
Yes, that's Raymond Setatal. Mm-hmm. And then that was sort of a liberating moment for a lot of boat builders who looked at that craft and said, oh, yeah, I remember how my grandfather used to build those, or my dad taught me how to build one. I hadn't built one of those in years. And that's essentially what happened with Mr. Cuvillier. And it's true of a lot of boat builders. Mr. Cuvillier also built a particular style of bateau that he hadn't really seen in 30 years, which, again, brings us back to that point that the capacity to hold an image in your mind and build what you see in your mind's eye was really striking in this family.
He didn't go into his house in the closet and pull out a blueprint from 30 years ago. That had just stayed in his head, the shape, the form, the dimensions of this boat.
Right.
So for those of us who don't know what a creole skiff is, mm-hmm. can you just briefly describe it?
Yeah, it's in fact, what makes it so great is that it is such a purely Louisiana boat. It's a rowboat, but it's flat on the bottom, but it's got nice contoured sides, and they are made of single broad planks, which was, you know, much more common in the days when we still had old growth cypress that were huge, huge trees, and you could get these large planks. And today they're increasingly rare. So those sides are nicely contoured, and they come back to a flat stern. But what makes it really, really distinctive is that every other rowboat in North America and in Europe, the rower sits facing the stern, and he or she's constantly looking back over his shoulder to correct their course and make adjustments. And you sit facing the stern, and that's fine if you're crossing the Chesapeake Bay or some other body of open water. It doesn't work so well in the swamps of Louisiana, where you got to navigate through cypress trees and other kinds of water hazards and so forth. So somewhere along the way, some Creole settler in Louisiana had the bright idea of saying, well, who says you have to face the back of a boat when you're rowing a boat? And who says you have to pull the oars? Why couldn't you push them? And who says you have to sit down to do it? So it just seemed to make sense to turn the rower around, have him facing the bow of the boat, have him standing up so that he could see what is in front of him, and to push very, very long oars that are highly maneuverable for making their way through shallow waters of the swamp. And so it was a totally innovative kind of rowboat. And I think that it's you can't overestimate what kind of revolutionary thinking that takes, because if you're like everybody else, when you think of a rowboat, you have an image in your mind that has been there for, you know, 1,000 years. People have been building rowboats the same way. So to see a rowboat in a different light, a different design, is real creativity.
Well, and we know that's a part of the culture.
Absolutely. It's adaptability to the environment.
It seriously is. And whether it's because, you know, some of our ancestors came from a place that was so different than where they landed, they had to be immediately creative and innovative, as you say, to adapt to the place. But it does seem to be a part of every facet of life here, whether it's cooking or fishing or farming, very creative. If you are just tuning in, my guest is Charles Richard, who is the director for the Center for the Moving Image Arts here at UL Lafayette. He's talking about his latest film called In the Mind of the Maker, which on the first ground level is about boat building and a very particular boat builder Edward Cuvillier, who's 85 years old. And the film is about his creation of this boat that he had not seen for 30 years.
Well, actually,
had not made for 30 years.
Right,
yes.
Yeah.
So that was in his head all that time. Mm-hmm. This film also brings in some very innovative technology that we have here at the university and imaging technology. So you chose Mr. Cuvillier to create this boat. And how much time did you spend with him out there? Where does he live?
He lives in an obscure little place called Mayette Point, mm-hmm. which is on Bayou Teche, and it's not far from the Chittimacha Indian Reservation in Sharonton and near Franklin in that area. The story of that community in and of itself is fascinating. There were a group of houseboat dwellers in the basin who were forced onto land by the Army Corps of Engineers. And instead of relocating the way that the Corps wanted them to, they said, no, we'll take care of ourselves. And apparently they simply got a bunch of big ropes. They hauled their houseboats over the top of the levee and turned them into houses on the other side.
Burden of dreams. Like.
That's right. They were eventually given a little plot of land where they are located now. That's called Mayette Point. I spent a lot of time along with our subject matter experts getting to know these folks. We spent a good year or so just talking with them and coming to understand them. this past spring, we got down to the real business of filmmaking. Mr. Edward, as I said, is 85, and we wanted to make sure that we could capture his transmission of this knowledge to his three sons while we still could. So we spent about 10 days straight with him at his place in his workshop, and we documented the process from taking this old Sinker Cypress lumber, which was estimated by one of our experts to be somewhere in the neighborhood of 3,000 years old. The wood itself came from trees that had been growing 2,000 to 3,000 years ago and had been sitting down in the bottom of the basin or under some swamp.
That's a documentary in itself.
It really
Charles.
Is.
I do have to read something that you posted on Facebook here.
Sure.
It just caught me and illustrated what you were experiencing, because there's not only just the film, but your entire experience of your subject matter, the place you are. And there's a great Facebook page in the Mind of the Maker. People can find it on mm-hmm. Facebook. And you have March 1st, drifting off to sleep, listening to the creaking hawsers that keep us moored to the banks of Bayou Teche. Director of photography Brian C. Miller Richard and I are camped aboard a houseboat on the gentle waters of the Teche tonight so we can catch the light of dawn tomorrow morning.
Yeah, that's right. I'd forgotten about
what
that.
What a great job you have.
Yeah, it was really a wonderful experience. And as I said, I've worked on a lot of different documentary films over the last 20 years, but none of them have been as personally important to me as this one. And just what a wonderful experience being welcomed into this this family, a very, very generous and hospitable family, and getting the opportunity to learn so much from them and from Mr. Cavillier, and not just about boat building. One of the first, the day after the night described there, we got up at dawn and we went out fishing with Mr. Cavillier in one of his wooden boats, because that's what he does. He doesn't need to anymore, but he has spent his whole life getting up every morning and running his trot lines, and that's what he does.
In a boat he's built.
Yeah, that's right. And so we went out with him, and I was fascinated by his processes for everything from gathering bait to running these lines. There's a unique kind of intelligence that – and problem-solving intelligence, I mean, that's evident in folks that live in these kinds of environments that really is elusive to – you know, the rest of us who are accustomed to air-conditioned houses and, you know, and picking up our food at the grocery store.
And there's a quietness and beauty to it, I'm sure, out there that, again, we will not name the series, but that doesn't get imparted, I think.
Yes. Let's put it this way. He's what you would think of as real swamp people.
Mm-hmm, real.
Yeah.
Well, now we are talking about filming here. Mm-hmm. So you've obviously got some camera equipment and your cinematographers mm-hmm. on this part of the experience. Mm-hmm. How did you do that? How did you have them coming along?
We're working with a really great team. There's some people that I've worked with in one capacity or another on other projects, and so we all knew each other quite well. I mentioned Connie Castile a little while ago, and she and I have partnered on many films together through the years. But we're also really, really fortunate to be working with some of what I believe are, without question, some of the top filmmaking artists in Acadiana. Brian C. Miller Richard and his fiancée Natalie Kingston were our camera department. We are working with Misty Talley, who's an extraordinary, extraordinary filmmaker in her own right, and she's serving as our post-production supervisor. She just got back from this year's Cannes Film Festival, where one of her works was featured. We're also working with something I've never done before, which is visual effects arts. And it's not really common to documentary. It's something that tends to be more associated with Hollywood
narrative films.
Yeah.
Well, that's going to be getting into some of the tech part here, but I guess you would need a really great team like that to give a sense of the beauty of the place and the depth of that culture that you're going into. That was very important to you.
Yeah, absolutely. And artists that you know and trust, I think that they've done an extraordinary job. I'd say that we're about halfway through, maybe, by my best estimate. So I'm excited about continuing to work with each of them and discovering more of their talents.
So how long did you spend again out there filming out in the water?
It was about a 10-day block. And That's not, again, typical the way documentaries are made. Usually you and the rest of the film would be made more conventionally, where you pick up an interview here, you shoot a day there or so. But we needed to capture from start to finish the construction of the boat. And so we spent the solid 10 days out there doing that.
Mm. And again, some of the photographs are on the Facebook page. Do you also have a website or blog? Or?
We've mostly been active on the Facebook page because it's been such a great way to
post easily.
Yeah, and also it's wonderful because we have so many wonderful and enthusiastic sort of followers for this project, and they are constantly sending us their photos and their memories of their boat building kinfolk and so forth. But we do have a web page as well, and we're going to be updating that very soon. It's simply mindofthemaker.co. That's co, not .com. Mm-hmm. Mindofthemaker.co, and we'll be posting some more video footage and some more photographs and so forth there as well.
Okay, just a great way for some people to get some images of what you've been doing and to follow the process that has been so fascinating. So in that 10 days, he constructed the boat?
That's right.
And I think I read once where the only measurement he made was the length of the boat, and that was it.
That's correct. Typically what Mr. Cuvillier will do when he goes to build a boat is he wants to know, if he's building it for somebody else, what do you want the length from the stem to the stern to be? And he says typically people try and tell him a lot more details, and he says after he doesn't really hear any of that. He doesn't need it. He just needs to know how long it needs to be from stem to stern. They did have the benefit of a little discovery that had been made in the swamp. Somebody found pieces of an old Creole rowing skiff. And that was a help to him, a visual aid to him, because he was able to look at some of the remains of an old Creole rowing skiff that is estimated to have been lost in the 1930s or so. And it was just enough for him to be reminded of the ones that he rowed in and piloted as a child and as a young man, and but no measurements and so forth, no compasses and you know, protractors or any of those kinds of things that you would expect. Yeah, and so he then working with his sons, his son Larry in particular is an especially gifted craftsman, as well as the other two sons. They were able to build this boat, and watching it come together in relatively short order, it was just an amazing thing to see.
And it is a beauty of a boat.
Again, it really is.
I encourage people to go find images on either the website or the Facebook page. So 10 days of filming out there on the water at his home while he's creating this boat. And then you come to the next part of the film that in your mind has been going on quite a while, that you're making this connection. Because as interesting as it is to simply document the old ways, we do live now, and we're fascinated by what happens in our minds now. How do we create, and what does that have to do with how our ancestors created and lived? And we have some incredible technology here at UL, the Light Center, which you mentioned, and you also mentioned some visualization that you've been working with another company for.
That's right.
So how did that start gathering in your mind, your maker mind, to create a film that brings these two worlds together?
I think it's important to remember that while right now visualization science and technologies are an extremely hot topic, I guess you'd say, there's a lot of investment being poured into that. The idea of mental imagery and visualization is actually a very, very old question. I mean, these are things that Plato and to some degree Aristotle talked about in their writings, and it was something that pops up in natural philosophy, science throughout the Middle Ages and so forth. But it became a really big topic in philosophy in the 18th and 19th centuries. And the first real studies of mental imagery by a genuine scientist were done in the 1890s. And throughout the 20th century. We're all familiar with the term the mind's eye. But when you really start thinking about how that works, it becomes a really interesting philosophical problem. How do we see things that aren't really there? And then see them clearly enough to be able to duplicate them into the material world. So one of the things that we did was we got in touch with we're very fortunate to have working with this Dr. Stephen Coslin. Dr. Coslin is I think it's fair to say, the world's leading expert on mental imagery in the field of cognitive neuroscience. He's former head of psychology from Harvard and formerly with Stanford and so forth. And all of the theories that he had been working with throughout the 1970s and 80s and 90s were somewhat controversial until the invention of MRI technology. And he was able to demonstrate, using these new visualization technologies, what was actually happening in the brain when we remember and when we visualize. And he was able to demonstrate that the very same parts of the brain are active when you picture something in great detail in your mind as when you're looking at that thing with your optical nerves, when the visual cortex is stimulated in the same ways. And he also makes the point that it's not just limited to visual stimuli. He says the same thing happens for musicians. They will hear the songs that they are composing. They'll hear them in their mind's ear, I guess, if you will, before they create the music. That's true of all of the senses. I think it's fair to say, bringing it back to Louisiana, we have some very gifted chefs who are able to smell and taste the foods that they want to make, the dishes they want to create before they actually come into existence. And that capacity is really just plain old imagination and memory.
I wouldn't say plain old when it comes to gifted chefs and gifted boat builders,
yeah.
Because obviously there is a difference in our abilities to image, imagine, and then create. Some obviously have greater gifts and skills than others.
Can I say something about that? And that is actually an important dimension of our film. The first scientific tests of mental imagery were carried out by Sir Francis Galton. He was an English scientist in the late 1800s, and he had a simple test. He contacted several hundred of his friends in the scientists, leading scientists in England at the time, and he asked them to simply describe in detail, picture in their mind's eye, what they had on the breakfast table in front of them that morning. And he was shocked by how many of them responded and said, well, I can tell you what I ate, but I can't see. What are you talking about? You know, I mean, seeing in my mind's eye. He found that there were tremendous variations in people's capacity to visualize. What we have found is that in modern times, that translates into some handicaps for people. One of the scholars in our film who's not from UL is Dr. Cheryl Sorby, and she has been interested in why it is that the dropout rate was so high among female engineering students. And what she found is that the ability for spatial thinking was measurably different among women than men. And the stereotype had always been, well, that's just because men's brains are hardwired differently than women's and so forth. And what her great contribution to the field has been is to say, no, it's true that we do have different capacities for visualization, but the brain is plastic enough that you can retrain your brain to achieve, you know, higher degrees of complexity in your visual thinking and so forth. And so she's created some remedial courses, essentially, that are just computer games that challenge students to take three-dimensional images, rotate them in their mind's eye, reconfigure them, and so forth. And what she's found is that she has been able, through these remedial exercises, to basically wipe out the gap between female engineering students and male engineering students.
Well, maybe with your film you could create some remedial boat building classes that would help.
Yes, we need to preserve those boats.
Yes, that's right, people who want to know how to make those boats. So you have all of the scientists, you contacted so many experts, and of course we have so many here at the university as well, to learn about the history of the science of visualization and to understand the value of that. So how did you merge that with your lovely documentary of a very tangible, cultural, iconic cultural experience like boat building? Mm-hmm. How did you bring that, using that science, into the present day?
I think that for us, the big thing that unlocked that problem, of how to put these two very different worlds of the primitive swamp environment and traditional crafts right alongside the high-tech visualization science that we have today. What allowed us to really make that connection has been visual effects. We're working with a wonderful company that's formerly out of Hollywood and now based here in Lafayette, and that's Pixel Magic. And the visual effects artists there have been able to help us bridge that gap. So essentially what we do at different stages of the boat's development in the story, we're able to bring the audience into the mind of the maker, essentially. Using computer-generated imagery and visual effects, we're able to kind of step out of the real world of the documentary, usual documentary conventions, and I hope give at least the impression of what Mr. Cavillier is doing in his imagination. We've spent a lot of time talking with him about what exactly is going on in his head.
What is he seeing?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. so we're working with some wonderfully talented artists at Pixel Magic, and in a style that we're thinking of as Da Vinci sketchbook, that allows us to do a kind of rendering of the boat's development in his imagination through line drawings and three-dimensional modeling and so forth with computer technology.
Has Mr. Cavillier seen any of these images?
No, not yet. And that's going to be kind of, I guess, the test of how accurate we are with this.
Mm-hmm. But. Well, and it reminds me of all those amazing special features we were all mm-hmm. treated to now, you know, before films like, oh, say, Lord of the Rings or something. Yeah. And you go into the mind of the costume designer mm-hmm. or the set designer, and with those wonderful techniques you're talking about, see that process.
Well, now you've put your finger on for me, my personal attraction to this. Mm-hmm. And it's because what filmmakers do is essentially what Mr. Cavillier does. You mm-hmm. have to see the movie in your mind's eye before you can set out to make it. And that, for me, is what put the hook in me for mm-hmm. this story.
Mm-hmm. So how does the Light Center come in? Are they involved mm-hmm. With any of the production? Or
no, what we're doing with the Light Center is working with some of the visualization scientists there. Of course, with Dr. Carolina Cruz is, you know, world-renowned for her, you know, pioneering work in virtual reality and 3D visualization. And so what we wanted to do was simply feature some of the work that she has done as a way of explaining how modern technologies are being used to mimic certain brain functions, to augment, you know, our capacities for imagination and visualization.
And I'm going to ask you to explain for us just quickly, mm-hmm. what the Light Center technology sure. is that is so special. I think we all know mm-hmm. the name. We know the egg. We know.
Sure.
But I think many people are still a little yeah. mystified.
Well, Light, of course, LITE, stands for Louisiana Immersive Technologies Enterprise. And immersive is the key word there. What the Light Center is dedicated to doing is using computers to create an immersive environment as much as possible that appeals to the senses, primarily the visual senses, to help the user to see what things that are otherwise difficult to see. Earlier I mentioned MRI machines, right? Before that, we had a pretty good idea through, you know, dissections and so forth, what the structures of the brain were. But we couldn't really get a handle on what was going on inside. We had a tough time imagining it until those technologies helped us to visualize them. The Light Center is dedicated in some ways to the same thing. It's used, been used by architects, for instance, in architectural planning so that they can create a three-dimensional image of the design they want to create. I've seen it used by pharmaceutical companies, for example, in constructing complex molecules for new developing drugs. And they can easily imagine what happens if we move this atomic structure from this part of the molecule to the other part. And it's computers that allow us to do that. Now, we can do these things with our mind's eye, but it's hard. It's really hard. And these computers help us to do what people who aren't as gifted, perhaps, as Mr. Cavillier can
do. I'm also imagining just the more knowledge we have, the more research that's done on cultural activities like boat building or architecture mm-hmm. of a very iconic house in Louisiana, right. other crafts, that as those people pass away mm-hmm. and they're no longer there to show, you can imagine an immersive experience
that's right.
where you could enter into one of the houses or enter into mm-hmm. one of those boats as you're describing yeah. and really understand and see what they might have mm-hmm. been seeing.
That's right. And yeah. I don't want to suggest that these technologies are in any way a substitute for our natural capacity to imagine and remember. Memory and imagination are neurologically very, very similar, very closely linked, and these computer technologies are no substitute for them. I mean, they're a wholly human and unique capacity that we have. But these technologies are indeed a big help in keeping us from losing things that we might otherwise lose.
Well, and that's what's so lovely in your film of the marriage of that very tangible experience of watching the boat builder and being in his environment, and yet also introducing us to the usefulness of the technology in explaining, extrapolating, and preserving. It is no substitute. And, and obviously, when we see images from your film, we long for that and wish it could be. But we also know the reality of some passing traditions. And
one of the things that struck me in my last interview, and I'm eager to talk with our neuroscientists about this, is Mr. Cavillier explained to us that before he'll build a boat, he'll spend hours and hours and hours in the weeks leading up to it, almost obsessively imagining it in his mind's eye. And he says it's the last thing he sees before he falls asleep at night and the first thing he sees before he opens his eyes. And he's trying to fix those proportions. You can imagine something in your mind, but to be able to come back to the same proportions each time you think of it, it's not easy. And he told us that it gets to the point sometimes where he's seeing the boat in his dreams. And that's something I haven't really talked yet with our neuroscientists about, is how the brain constructs visual imagery and imagines these things in vivid dreaming. So we still have a lot of work we're doing on this film, and it's exciting to be in the middle of it. It's fun to see some of it accomplished, but still more to do.
And I could imagine the fun of trying to visualize those dreams in a film, creating with your technicians with pixel magic. Yeah. Very interesting. So many levels to this film. If you are just tuning in, we're talking about the film In the Mind of the Maker, created by my guest Charles Richard, who is the director for the Center for Moving Image Arts here at UL Lafayette, and has been working on this film in earnest over the past year, and has been thinking about it and visualizing it for quite a while now. He's been so interested in that subject. And of course, your collaborators, Ray Brasseur and
Jim Delahousie.
Jim Delahousie.
I should also mention the executive producer for this project, John Durrell, who's been such an incredibly loyal and faithful believer in this project from the beginning. There was a time when raising money for a documentary film was a little bit easier, and when there was, as I mentioned before, state funding for these kinds of projects, and that's dried up now. And so it requires a unique kind of creativity from people like the executive producer here, John, to come up with the funds to make a movie like this possible. It's a very ambitious film and an expensive one. So I don't want to give short shrift to the kind of creativity that comes from a producer.
Well, yeah, that's right. Well, that's always interesting, because I think we've all had the experience of sitting in a movie theater and somebody inevitably says, "What does the producer do?" You've just explained it right there.
Exactly. Among other things, he does a lot of things.
That's right. Well, has the skiff had its maiden voyage?
Yes, it has. It was tested very briefly during the boat show in Franklin back in April, I believe. And that was really just to see whether or not it was seaworthy. And actually, it was a good thing we did, just because Cyprus needs to be in the water to expand and fill in any cracks and gaps and so forth. If you take a Cyprus boat out, it's going to shrink and dry. So it needed to be wetted down. On the last day of our filming, though, sometime after that, after the boat had been finished and given some paint and things like that, we used the last day of our filming schedule to launch the boat from the Teche Marina, which is a wonderful place there on Bayou Teche, not far from where Mr. Cavillier lives. And it was just wonderful to see him standing up in this boat. It was around sunset on a Sunday evening. And, you have to remember, this is a boat that he used to pilot in the 1930s and 40s. His sons were joking a little bit about whether or not his dad's going to still remember how to work those oars, because it takes practice to be able to be effective at it. Let me tell you, that old man, he picked up those oars and he knew exactly what he was doing.
His muscle memory had not forgotten
that.
That's
exactly right.
Yeah. So you got some footage of that.
Yes.
Him standing in that skiff.
Absolutely. Beautiful, beautiful footage to see. Something that you just don't see on Bayou Teche and hasn't been seen probably in half a century or more.
And there's no substitute for that real image over those visualizations that you're creating. And what is the progress of the film now? What's going to happen now? You've done your filming in the wild, and you're working in the studio now to create these visualizations. What's the timetable?
It's a good question, actually. We had decided our top priority was going to be in capturing the folkloric elements of this. And you know, the time that we have with Mr. Cuvillier is limited and it's precious, and we wanted to make sure that we made the most of it. And so we dedicated all of our resources up front to capturing the boat-building portions of this. Now that we've done that, we're shifting to the more I guess, research-oriented and scientific-oriented portions of the film. We still have a lot of work to do in talking about boat building, aspects of boat building, and we'll be hearing a lot more from Dr. Ray Barsur about the history and heritage of that. But we're also going to be beginning our interviews with our neuroscientists, our engineering scholars, and so forth, and talking about some of the connections between those unique capacities of our ancestors in today's modern maritime industries. People don't realize that Louisiana is, of course, one of the leading states in the country for ship construction and boat design, and all of the innovations that come out of this place, I think, can really be traced back to that same kind of tradition that you find in Mr. Cuvillier. So we're shifting our attention to those things now. And right now we're back in the mode of raising the resources necessary to do the second half of the film.
Well, we'll look forward to having you back and perhaps Ray Barsur as the film nears its completion, because I know you'll be sending it out, I'm sure, to festivals. And so many people will be fascinated by the culture here in Louisiana and how you've put together those two worlds, those two worlds of a very classic culture and very modern scientific efforts. If you are tuning in, we're talking about the film In the Mind of the Maker, created by my guest, Charles Richard. He's a documentary filmmaker and also the director of the Center for Moving Image Arts here at UL Lafayette, using so many of the resources here at the university as he's creating this film. And as we mentioned earlier, Charles, there are places people can go online to find out more about the film and to see images. Tell us about those.
Sure. I think the first and best place to go right now is to our Facebook page. And if you go to Facebook and you search for In the Mind of the Maker Film, it'll take you to our Facebook page. And we update that very, very routinely. We also have a website that we are beginning to repopulate with new content now. It's simply mindofthemaker.co, that's .co. And I understand that there's going to be an article coming out later this week in a very popular outdoors magazine that's online called The Outpost Magazine. And so people who are interested in the latest doings for that can check out a new article that's all about the film in The Outpost Magazine.
Will they have some images?
Yes, actually, I was asked to write an article about the sort of my reflections on working with the Cuvilliers as we wrapped up our shooting with them. And so we have some images that are actually taken directly from the raw footage that our cinematographer, Brian Richard, shot.
Well, we'll look forward to seeing those images, and what a lovely, incredible experience it's been for you, and how valuable for all of your students here in the program, in the Moving Image Arts Center, for them to observe as you're creating and living your professional life as a filmmaker and seeing that process as you go through it.
Yeah, I should really give some acknowledgement to them, because they've been an important part of this. Although the film itself is not a university production, we've tried very hard wherever possible to make internship opportunities, learning opportunities available to students from our program. And so we've had some wonderfully ambitious and talented young people that have come to work with us. Eva Morgan in the editorial department, as well as Dylan Meinhardt and Michael Hilbin in visual effects, and so many others who've contributed in wonderful ways. And I'm hoping that it's something that they'll be able to carry with them into their professional lives too.
Right, and to give them a sense that the entire filmmaking process can be done in Louisiana. Because even though we talk about how many films and television series are being made in Louisiana, there's also this idea that people just come in and do it and leave. But the process you're talking about is from its conception here and created in Louisiana.
There's a lot of interest outside of Louisiana in this. We previewed the project at last year's Cannes Film Festival just to kind of gauge the interest among distributors in the project to see if we really – want to go forward with this investment. And we were delighted to find that it was very well received among European distributors. They were very excited about the idea that there are some Americans who speak French and English equally. So there's a lot of interest in cultural stories that come out of Louisiana. And I think that something that connects the sciences with our traditional culture is something that's going to be a big challenge to some of the common stereotypes that are out there in the media.
Absolutely.
About us.
We do that so well here, but you're right, it doesn't always get told as effectively as your film will tell that story.
Thank you.
The film we're talking about is In the Mind of the Maker. The director is Charles Richard. The creator is Charles Richard. And you can find so much more on the web through those various sites that he's talking about. Thank you so much, Charles.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate you sharing this.